Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group and was recorded on Thursday, March 7th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today we'll be discussing the targeted killing of U.S. citizens. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future, and unlike many of our telephone conference calls, this call is open to press. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of our three experts of about 5 to 8 minutes in turn, followed by some open discussion among the experts, and then we'll be getting to the audience questions. We'll hear first from Professor Stephen Vladeck of American University Law School, second from Professor John Yu of Berkeley Law School, and finally from Andy McCarthy, Executive Director of the Philadelphia Freedom Center. As we typically do, their bios have been provided to you in a notice of today's call and is also available on our website, so I'm not going to belabor you with longer introductions. So, Professor Vladeck, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Great. Thank you very much, Dean. Thank you for arranging this teleform and for inviting me to participate. I think this is obviously a very pressing conversation. I thought I'd start us off today by setting the stage, since I suspect folks are in various places of background knowledge on the issue. So what really got this conversation going was the disclosure by NBC News back on February 4th of this year of a white paper prepared by the Justice Department, ostensibly for the purposes of briefing members of Congress, that purported to set forth the legal criteria that the Obama administration has used when deciding under what narrow circumstances it has the authority to use lethal force, whether through a drone strike or otherwise, against a U.S. citizen overseas. And the white paper sets out three principal criteria. First, the U.S. citizen must be a senior operational leader of al-Qaeda. Second, he must present an imminent and ongoing threat to U.S. national security, although there's some debate about just how the white paper defines imminence. And third, and perhaps most importantly, the capture of this individual must be infeasible. So it must be the case that this individual is somewhere where neither we nor the country in which he's located are in a position to effectuate a lawful arrest. And that's why most of this conversation is limited to parts of the world where there is not very well-functioning civil authority, for example, the battlefields of Afghanistan and the border regions of Pakistan, parts of Yemen, parts of Somalia. Now, the white paper, I think, sort of raised more questions than it answered because it necessarily raised the issue of whether the authority that the Obama administration claimed with regard to drone strikes against U.S. citizens overseas might also extend to strikes against U.S. citizens within the domestic United States. And so this helped to lead to three different letters sent by Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky to John Brennan, the president's nominee to be the next director of the Central Intelligence Agency. The letters were dated January 25th, February 12th, and February 20th. And although there are different queries in each of the letters, the central question that Senator Paul put to Mr. Brennan was whether the president has the power to authorize lethal force, such as a drone strike, against a U.S. citizen on U.S. soil and without trial. Mr. Brennan never actually responded directly, but the Attorney General sent a reply, a written reply to Senator Paul on Monday of this week, in which he generally disclaimed the power of the United States government to use lethal force against U.S. citizens on U.S. soil, but did not say it's never, basically said there could be circumstances where the use of force would be permissible, and indeed the letter specifically refers to Pearl Harbor and 9/11 as circumstances in which it would have been legal for the government to use lethal force even against its own citizens if it was truly necessary. That letter, I think, helped to provoke an exchange yesterday when Attorney General Holder testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing as part of its regular oversight function. There were a series of exchanges between the Attorney General and Senator Ted Cruz of Texas and Senator Mike Lee of Utah and a couple of other members of the committee trying to get the Attorney General to say more definitively that the answer was never, that the government could never, in fact, use such force against a U.S. citizen on U.S. soil. And I think true to form with his letter of March 4th, the Attorney General wouldn't say never, but when, for example, Senator Cruz pressed him on hypotheticals about U.S. citizens sitting at a cafe minding their own business, the Attorney General, I think, with some coaching, eventually said, yes, no, we couldn't attack that person in that circumstance. Of course, this all sort of led to the bigger headline from yesterday, which was Senator Paul's subsequent filibuster of the nomination of the vote on the nomination of Mr. Brennan to be the next director of the CIA, which lasted about 13 hours. And, you know, during the filibuster, Senator Paul made a number of fairly extraordinary, and I have to say, outlandish, I think, suggestions about how broad the authority the government claims actually is. In fact, I think the Obama administration has been relatively clear that it would only use lethal force against U.S. citizens on U.S. soil in the most extreme circumstances, and that those circumstances would almost never be present. At the same time, it's not that preposterous to believe that there are some circumstances where such force is permissible. Law enforcement officers are routinely allowed to use lethal force in certain circumstances to resist, to defend themselves, to resist violence to others, to stop fleeing felons who pose a threat to others. You know, the death penalty is an example of the use of lethal force against our own citizens. So I think the Attorney General was trying to sort of walk a fine line that Senator Paul did not really appreciate. So that takes us up to the present. And what I'd like to do before turning things over to Professor Yu is just to offer three brief reflections on the current controversy. First, I really have to say that with all due respect to the junior senator from Kentucky, I don't think drone strikes in the U.S. against U.S. citizens is the real issue here. You know, I think the Obama administration has been quite clear that it would never, ever use that authority except in an extreme emergency situation, the likes of which are not that hard to figure out. And trying to sort of walk the administration into all these tricky hypotheticals, I think, belies the larger point, which is that this is a conversation about things that would practically never happen. But at the same time, I do think that the pervasiveness of drone strikes overseas, especially against non-citizens, but also against citizens, is a cause for concern. So, for example, Senator Lindsey Graham, who, you know, as a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee is privy to this information, said publicly a couple of weeks ago that upwards of 4,700 people have been killed by U.S. drone strikes since September 11th. That's a pretty remarkable number. And in this regard, the DOJ white paper is not at all helpful. So if the larger point of Senator Paul's filibuster was to require more of a public accounting from the administration and to use the leverage of Mr. Brennan's nomination to achieve that accounting, then even if some of the things he said were pretty outlandish, I'm not sure that the larger point isn't a fair one. So finally, I mean, if what we need is greater oversight and greater accountability, you know, if that's the goal here, then I think the question simply becomes how to accomplish that oversight and that accountability, whether the answer is through more active exercise of Congress's oversight function and or more of a role for the judiciary, perhaps after the fact, if not beforehand. To that end, we've seen some proposals in the last couple of weeks for Congress to create some kind of after-the-fact damages cause of action so that there could be some review of drone strikes in situations where their legality is questioned. But whatever the actual answer is, it seems like the larger point here is the extent to which we shouldn't just have to take the government's word for it, and that there should be at least more public accountability, more transparency, more light of day on exactly when the government does believe it has the authority to use lethal force, especially outside of the country, where it seems far more willing to do so. So why don't I stop there and turn it over to Professor John Yu. John.
Thanks. First, I can't help but comment immediately on Senator Rand Paul, just because his filibuster, because that's the most immediate news we have today and the likely confirmation, I think, of Mr. Brennan to be director of the CIA. I admire libertarians, but I think Rand Paul's filibuster in many ways is very much like what libertarians do. They make these very symbolic gestures, standing for some extreme position, some extreme reading of freedom or liberty, and then they walk off without having achieved anything meaningful in terms of real government policy. It sort of reminds me of the young kids when they first read The Fountainhead or Atlas Shrugged, and they suddenly think that taxation equals slavery and they're not going to pay any federal taxes anymore. But you can't exile yourself from your duty to pay taxes in the end. And unfortunately, I think the senator's filibuster has a lot of those same features, at least to me. I think it was sort of noble and interesting to try to reinvigorate what the filibuster really is, which is someone actually standing on the floor of the Senate and speaking and refusing to consent to business as usual. On the other hand, Senator Paul lost. I don't think he's going to get a lot of votes to oppose Mr. Brennan, and the better thing would have been to try to work to try to get opposition to Mr. Brennan in the Senate, or to work through the Senate to try to change policy in the direction that he would like, either through oversight or funding. There's a whole sweep of other matters. The second thing I'd say on the matter of the substance is I do happen to think Senator Paul is incorrect. I think that the attorney, I don't often say this, but I think the attorney general has the right bottom line. Unfortunately, I think he gets there in the wrong way, and he does it in sort of the most politically, politically incompetent manner. I think it is right that if an American joins an enemy with which we're at war, he is or she is a valid target as an enemy combatant. And that's been the rule throughout our history. People in the Civil War were all Confederates in the Civil War were all American citizens, but the ones that took up arms were members of the enemy. And, of course, I think many people on the call are familiar with the case of the Nazi saboteurs who were judged to be enemy combatants by ultimately even by the Supreme Court, even though one, if not two, of the Nazi saboteurs who came ashore and were captured by the FBI were American citizens. Nonetheless, they were not, required to go to a federal court for a criminal trial. They were tried by a military commission and ultimately held by the, which was ultimately held by the Supreme Court. However, I think the problem is that because Attorney General Holder and this administration think that enemy combatants abroad and in the United States are entitled to the same kinds of due process rights, they are instilling a level of fear and concern is wholly unnecessary, although I think that, unfortunately, I think this is the way this administration does business. And the problem is that the enemy abroad, I think, in contradiction to the white paper that was released, do not have due process rights. There is no duty to capture members of the enemy with which we're at war. There is no duty to ask if they're, quote unquote, continually planning attacks. There's no duty to balance the government's interest versus the due process right interests of the target, which is all called for in the white paper. These are law enforcement standards that apply to police officers in the United States. They've never been applied by the American military when we're at war, and they would make war impractical. And the drone issue is not really the main issue. Drones is just a technology. If you believe that these standards apply to drones, then according to the Obama approach, they should apply to the use of snipers, artillery, bomber, anytime you're killing from a distance or by surprise. Right? Why do drones change the due process rights, alleged due process rights of defense, of targets, not defendants, excuse me? If that's true, though, if this administration thinks that these due process rights exist for members of Al-Qaeda abroad and limit the way that targets can be selected and attacked, then that's why they're causing all this concern by people like Rand Paul and lots of other people, is because those same due process standards apply domestically. And it must be the case, then, that they would apply and think it through the same way domestically when they do abroad. I think that's completely mistaken, because those due process standards apply to law enforcement activity as well as military activity under, I would think, the Obama administration's approach. And that's why I think you do have these hypotheticals, which I think they're finding very difficult to answer, because they can't just say, right, like I think Ramble has this amusing hypothetical about Jane Fonda. Would Jane Fonda have been an enemy combatant after she came back from visiting North Vietnam and came back to the United States? Could you have shot her with a drone? You know, this is appealing to many conservatives, I suppose, of the Rand Paul persuasion, because they just want to get Jane Fonda. I just think Jane Fonda is a bad actress. I don't think we need to do anything worse to her. Anyway, I don't think you can target Jane Fonda with a drone. I don't think she's taken up arms. I don't think she's a member of North Vietnam. The armed forces are part of their military leadership when she comes over. But I think if you have these concerns about how due process is defined that are raised by extending them to everybody we encounter on the battlefield, then people are right to worry, I'm afraid, that domestically, well, how does this administration interpret due process? No, I think the answer is quite simple. if there's an attack on the country, if there are a renovation of the country, if the United States is entitled to use force in its self-defense, it's entitled to use force under the laws of war, it doesn't have to give due process rights or hearings to any of those people that we're encountering who might have made it, unfortunately, here to carry out attacks. And the drone issue shouldn't change. If, say, I'm not so much worried about a 9/11 style attack or a December 7th attack, which is strange, I think, that Mr. Holder raised that as an example. I would be worried about something like Mumbai, where small bands of men armed with light arms go around and shoot up an American city or attack high-profile targets that are soft and are populated by civilians. I think we would expect that our government would respond to those kinds of attacks, not just by sending out the police, but by sending out the military if necessary. If you can use force in that situation, you can use drones just like you could use snipers or just combat troops. And it seems to be a mistake for this administration to think that the same due process rights that apply to Americans at home who are accused of criminal activity should also protect people who have invaded the country or attacking the country or are launching some kind of terrorist attack inside the country from abroad, and that somehow limits the America's ability to use force in self-defense. So now I'll turn it over to Andy, my good friend Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, John. I essentially agree with John's analysis. I would say that the thing I thought was most interesting in both the hearing that the Attorney General testified in and then in Senator Paul's filibuster, the parts of it that I was able to see, was that you would never know from listening to the dialogue and to the monologues that we were actually at war under a congressional authorization of military force. In fact, that is the case. There is a sweeping authorization of military force that is in effect. It has been supplemented by other legislation. I'm thinking of the Military Commission Acts in 2006 and 2009 in particular, which gave fairly sweeping definitions of who the enemy combatants are in the war. And I think that's worth underscoring because, as I'm aware of it, I think in the history of the United States, when Congress, the few times that it has in our history, explicitly authorized the use of military force against an identifiable enemy, that is the commencement of a political exercise, not a legal exercise. And a lot of this discussion, and this is true, I think, going all the way back to 2001, a lot of this discussion takes place as if our underlying assumption ought to be that we were in the midst of a legal exercise, and what we were groping for was what processes do under the circumstances. Whereas I think that when the country goes to war, particularly when the country goes to war, not just in response to an attack or an imminent attack, but where the people's representatives have authorized the commander-in-chief to use military force in a sweeping way and with a definition of an identifiable enemy, there is very little cause, in my view, for courts to be involved in that at all. And I think it would have been shocking to the framers that we'd gotten to the place where we now simply assume that the American people's courts are available to be used as basically a weapon of war by the enemy against the American people's war effort, which has been authorized by the American people's representatives. I think they would have thought that was an absurd concept. I had sympathy for Attorney General Holder yesterday, particularly when he was being browbeaten by Senator Cruz. And I say that with a little bit of resignation because Senator Cruz is one of my favorites. And, to put it mildly, Attorney General Holder isn't. But I thought that Attorney General Holder's reluctance to use the term unconstitutional and instead to say that it would be inappropriate for an attack to take place, a drone attack against an American citizen who ostensibly at least was a non-combatant in wartime circumstances. I understood, I think, why the Attorney General was reluctant to use the label unconstitutional and substitute it with something that was more equivocal. And that's because, you know, having been involved not only in this debate for a number of years, but also in the methodology of jihadist warfare, I can imagine a number of circumstances where somebody who was ostensibly a non-combatant would actually be contributing in a material way to a jihadist war effort. And, you know, to be a little bit more concrete about it, the defendant who I prosecuted in the mid-1990s, or one of them, I guess the most prominent of them, the blind sheikh, was someone who was utterly incapable of doing anything that you would think of as useful to a terrorist organization. He couldn't build a bomb. He couldn't conduct an assassination. The only thing he was capable of doing was running it, because he was somebody who was an acknowledged master of not just jihadist ideology, but Sharia law. You know, somebody who was graduated with a doctorate in Islamic jurisprudence from Al-Azhar University in Egypt, and was renowned throughout the world as somebody who was an authority in Islamic law. And therefore, under the way that our enemies operated, a terrorist act could not take place unless somebody in authority like the blind sheikh was there to greenlight it. And that was not something that he needed to do from the front lines by any stretch of the imagination. He ordered terrorist attacks from mosques, from his apartment, and he's even, according to Osama bin Laden, he gave the fatwa that approved the 9/11 attacks from his American prison cell. So to the extent that the Attorney General, knowing that, as John pointed out, it has long been the law of the United States that if you are an American citizen and you join the enemy in warfare against the United States in wartime, you can be treated like the enemy. We can detain you. We can try you by military commission, and in the Kieran case, even execute you after a military commission within about 7 weeks of the time you're captured. Knowing that, knowing how the enemy operates, if the Attorney General is being equivocal because he could imagine some scenarios where there might in fact be some question about whether it was unconstitutional to have that kind of attack, he had my sympathy in that regard. And with that, why don't I stop there and send it back to Dean.
Thank you very much to each of you for those opening remarks. We've got quite a few people on the phone. I want to get to their questions as soon as possible, but I want to hear again from Professor Vladek before we do that. Before I go back to Professor Vladek, let me just announce that tomorrow we have a telephone conference call at 1 p.m. Eastern Time featuring Yale Law School Professor Jonathan Macy. He'll be talking about his new book, The Death of Corporate Reputation. Check your calendars for that. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Professor Vladek, do you want to respond to something one of the other speakers said?
Sure. Just briefly, Dean, thanks. And thanks to John and Andy for their thoughtful comments. So I just want to make three very brief points that I think will hopefully, you know, maybe advance the ball a little bit. So first, with regard to the due process rights of American citizens who take up arms against us, I mean, the Supreme Court has actually never said that citizens categorically forfeit their due process rights when they allegedly join the enemy. Indeed, without due process, there would be no way for citizens to challenge the government's assertion that they are, in fact, someone who has joined enemy forces during wartime, that they are, in fact, for example, a member of al-Qaeda. To the contrary, the Supreme Court in the Hamdi case in 2004 specifically held that a U.S. citizen captured on the battlefield in Afghanistan is still entitled to a meaningful opportunity to challenge his status before a neutral decision maker. And that's a battlefield captured in Afghanistan, where I have to think that the government's force and its power is at its zenith, to say nothing of a capture off the battlefield. As for Andy McCarthy's point, I mean, I agree with the basic idea and the reminder that we are engaged in an armed conflict with al-Qaeda. But as Hamdi again made clear, the AUMF is not a blank check. To the contrary, Hamdi, Hamdan, and Boumediene, the Supreme Court's three big cases in this area, I think make abundantly clear not just that the courts should play a role in these kinds of cases, but that they can do so in a way that adequately balances the government's interests with those of, you know, the individual terrorism suspect. I mean, I dare say that other issues aside, you know, the Guantanamo habeas jurisprudence of the past 5 years has been a model in this regard, where the government has been able to use classified information as evidence, where the detainees have been represented by security-cleared counsel, and where neutral judges have decided after the fact, you know, was this person in fact who the government believes they were? Were they subject to the use of military force? I'm not sure why that would be any harder in this context. Instead, it seems to me, and this is the last point I'll make before shutting up, you know, I think the hardest question is what due process actually requires where a U.S. citizen like Anwar al-Awlaki is concerned. And my own view, for what it's worth, is that due process requires at least a meaningful opportunity to challenge the government's decision-making process, maybe after the fact, as in Hamdi, but always before a neutral decision-maker. Because the problem is that due process otherwise is just a fiction. It is just the government saying, you know, due process is whatever we deem it to be. And that's never been how we've understood due process, even for our most mortal enemies during wartime, at least so long as they were protected by the due process clause, as all U.S. citizens are. So that's just a couple thoughts in response, and I suspect that may have provoked John and Andy into responding to me.
Professor Yu, do you have more to add?
Yeah, I just want to make a few more points. One is the due process clause, of course, is not limited just to citizens. It just says it's limited to persons. So one would think, under this logic, that due process clause rights in wartime don't just apply to American citizens; they apply to everyone. Just the way the due process clause in the United States applies to aliens who live here just as well as citizens, along with, you know, pretty much all the rest of the Bill of Rights. So does this mean that due process rights occur to not just Anwar al-Awlaki, but Osama bin Laden too? So that's one. Second, it seems to me, I do agree that the way this administration reads due process rights basically makes the rights meaningless, which is exactly why the due process rights shouldn't apply. I mean, if you think that members of the enemy, people like Anwar al-Awlaki or Osama bin Laden, get due process rights, and this administration thinks what happened with them actually was due process, then they have effectively read due process to be very little. I would think that due process rights after the fact, when you just question how the administration just went through the process of picking targets and what level of evidence, I think this would be wholly inappropriate and an intrusion into the executive branch's management of, or the political branches too, because Congress hasn't said not to do it this way, but the political branch's management of war. But suppose one did that and thought that was due process, then I think you've really narrowed due process rights to be very, very little in this context. But the third thing is, the courts have never said that members, United States citizens who join members of the enemy forfeit their due process rights. And certainly the court has said that if you're detained by the United States, you have some kind of due process rights. And we're seeing now in the lower courts what that actually means. But I don't think any court also has ever said that, you know, an American who joins a member of the enemy armed forces and we encounter them in combat still has due process rights. How would you actually put this into practice? I mean, if you take World War II, for example, number of Germans, German Americans, Italian Americans, Japanese Americans went back and joined up, went back after war started and joined up with their original home countries. And many fought in the uniformed armed forces of the enemy. We supposed to pause the fighting and have an interview with each of these folks before we can. You can't carry out due process rights in this way because you can't tell oftentimes in combat exactly who's who before you launch, hopefully, a surprise attack or attack from a distance, which will reduce the possibility of harm to our own forces. So if you want to actually put this kind of due process idea into effect, which I think we never have in wartime, I mean, look at all the past wars. We have unfortunately faced Americans who have fought against us in the uniformed armed forces of the enemy, and we haven't provided them due process. No one has ever thought they had them. But if we were to do that, I think it would not just I think it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to put into practice in any kind of combat way, but also it would have to, I think, invariably lead to the United States troops and forces having to become more vulnerable and to take more risks and putting more American fighting troops' lives at stake because of having to carry out more process than would normally be the case in normal combat operations. Andy?
The only thing I'd add to that is, you know, the administration has said again and again, and I agree with this actually, that due process has never meant judicial process in every circumstance. It's the process that's due under the circumstances, meaning all the circumstances. And for that reason, I don't think anybody ought to be offended by the idea that what Anwar al-Awlaki is entitled to in Yemen is different, perhaps, than what, say, Jose Padilla is entitled to coming off a plane in Chicago. I disagree with Stephen's assessment that because the Supreme Court has never made the explicit statement that you can treat an American citizen just like the enemy if he joins the enemy in wartime, that that's not the case. We can certainly infer that from, number one, its decision in the Kieran case, and I think it's reaffirmed, actually, by Hamdi, which says that while you are entitled now to some quantum of process if you've been captured, the court explicitly did not say that that necessarily had to be judicial process, and in fact said that it could be the process akin to what goes on in a combatant status review tribunal.
Okay, very good. As I mentioned before, we've got quite a few people on the phone, so let's see what's on their minds today. In a moment, we should all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We'll get to as many of your questions as possible. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, my name is Devin. I stand with Rand and his filibuster the other night, but I wanted to talk for a moment about about Americans overseas, people that have United States citizenship overseas. Now, obviously, on a battlefield, if they're holding a weapon, if they're threatening lives, either directly or remotely, Americans, we need to kill them right away. But for targeted killings, where the person we are targeting we know is a American citizen, I don't see why we can't, in advance, assuming some of these targeting decisions are weeks or months long, why we can't go to a court and ask that their, say, citizenship is revoked. I know that there's a part of the U.S. Code that says, well, these are all the different ways your citizenship can be revoked. And one of them is, being convicted of treason, and another one is voluntarily saying it and things like that.
Who wants to respond to that?
Yeah, this is Andy McCarthy. I don't see how that would work practically. I mean, first of all, I think the same people who think that due process would require that would also tell you that due process required that the person had an opportunity to come to court and contest
Anwar al-Awlaki is a great example. We've known about him for a long time. We knew about him for like at least 6 months. He was publicly declared an enemy and whatnot. And we could have gone to the court and said, we wish to provide the evidence that this person is working against the United States and have his citizenship revoked. And then lay out the case and say, if he shows up, we will let him provide his side of the case or whatnot.
And should we then have the court decide what the appropriate military targets are, too?
No, I'm just saying that if there...
I don't know. Once you start to go down this road, the identification of the enemy, particularly once Congress has authorized warfare and identified an enemy, it's the commander-in-chief's decision to make who the enemy is.
But Andy, by that logic, then there'd be no role for courts to play in reviewing whether an individual who's detained has been properly detained either.
Right.
And
that's exactly
I think,
right.
And you may feel that way, but I think we're on the far side of a handful of Supreme Court decisions that hold to the contrary. And I think, you know, the reality is, once you believe that there's an appropriate role for the courts to play in reviewing detention decisions, at least after the fact, I'm not sure why it's so much of a stretch to say that after the fact, courts can review targeting decisions as well. I don't think they're reviewing them de novo, but insofar
as... this is exactly the one-way ratchet. Once you let the courts into this area, which they traditionally had never been in before 2004, there's always going to be one more incremental thing that used to be a duty of the commander in chief, which is now going to be, overseen by the courts.
I disagree. I mean, this is Steve. I think that the Constitution actually draws a fairly bright line here. I think it would be hard to actually have a justiciable case or controversy if the government was just going to a court beforehand and seeking a warrant to put someone like Anwar al-Awlaki on a kill list. I think if the question is just whether a U.S. citizen who believes he was killed pursuant to an illegal use of force by the government can pursue damages after the fact, and I'm not sure why his ability to pursue relief should depend on whether the government says he's an enemy combatant or just a dangerous felon. I mean, I think in both cases, he should have a right of access to the courts, and if he loses, he loses. I mean, if we think, as in the case of al-Awlaki, the government had plenty of evidence to justify what they did, and there weren't any other constraints on the government's power, then, it's a meritless lawsuit. But I think that's not the same thing as saying no suit whatsoever.
But why should this only apply to drones, and why should it only apply to Americans? I think under this approach, anyone who's ever killed by the United States in wartime, by whatever means, doesn't have to be drones. Drones, I think we should be clear, drones don't change the legal equation. They are the technology, but... Why drones are not fundamentally different than snipers, right, or artillery?
Well, I agree with that, but Andy, I think the critical difference is...
Can I finish my point? I didn't get to say anything. So the point is, if it's drones or snipers or whatever, and the Due Process Clause applies not just to Americans, it applies to non-Americans too, their rights may be, I'm not a big believer in this, but maybe their rights are on some kind of sliding scale, the farther away you get from the country, and that's the way the court kind of has suggested it in Verdugo or Quidez and cases like that. But then, and this is a concern, why can't everyone who's ever been killed by the United States in wartime bring a similar suit and say, especially in this kind of war, right? I mean, that's the other big problem, is that we have members of the enemy who don't wear uniforms, and so it's much harder to tell who is and who isn't a member of the enemy. But why can't anyone killed by a drone or a sniper, special forces, file suit in federal court and ask for the United States to explain how they picked him or her as a target? And doesn't even have to be a suit against the president, right? Why can't it be suits against the lower military officials or intelligence officers who also gave the green light to taking lethal action?
I mean, so all I'll say that, John, is I think if you want to start from the proposition that non-citizens outside the United States with no substantial connection to the United States have due process rights as a way to say that this would be a really bad idea, I think that's setting up a straw man. I mean, I think the Supreme Court has never suggested that a non-citizen outside the United States is protected by the Due Process Clause. So, I don't think it's the slippery slope you suggest. I think it's just a question of, should the government be held to a slightly higher standard when it's using military force against its own citizens?
So you take the view that no non-citizens outside the U.S. have any due process rights?
I take the view that it's currently the law of the land that non-citizens outside the U.S. who lack a substantial voluntary connection to the United States aren't protected by the Due Process Clause. I mean, I could imagine a scenario where that wasn't
But they're protected by the Habeas Corpus Clause, right?
But I mean, the habeas corpus laws are a remedy. I mean, you still have to habeas corpus is a remedy. You still have to actually argue that there's a right. And in that context, the argument in the Guantanamo cases isn't that their detention violates due process. It's that their detention isn't actually authorized by Congress. So, all I'm suggesting here is that if the conversation is about U.S. citizens, I'm not sure that it's that much of an intrusion, especially given the current precedent, for courts to review after the fact whether the government, in fact, was lawfully using force. I think, compared to what we've seen over the last 5 years, that wouldn't be that much of a departure at all.
The next departure never is much of one.
Well, but if you're arguing against Hamdi, Hamdan, and Boumediene, then, I think this is a different conversation.
Well, gentlemen, this is fascinating. We've got my switchboard here is lit up pretty well. If you don't mind, let's go to our next audience member and take another question.
This is awesome, gentlemen. My name is Tom Gaten. I wanted a question. I did stand with Rand last evening, but it was on a different merit. And let me, I'm curious what your opinion on this is. I think your comments are absolutely outstanding. But isn't there an automatic escape clause, and that's what Rand was referring to, and that is the imminent threat clause, much like Lincoln used because of the threats against the sixth Massachusetts that gave him granted him the authority to engage in battle, and because there was an imminent threat posed. I mean, isn't that the core of what Rand is referring to? Is that we all understand that there's legalese here, but the president and the federal government is given a great deal of rope when it comes to the imminent threat portion of this.
This is Andy McCarthy. Could I just let me just throw this out at the beginning, because this kept entering into my head while I was listening to Senator Paul on that. Let's say that you have the blind sheik, except he's an American citizen, sitting in the cafe, seemingly passive, except his role in the way the enemy organizes itself is his go-ahead is required before, you know, his yes or no before they can attack anything. Is he an imminent threat sitting in the cafe minding his own business until the phone rings?
Can I push your hypothetical even farther, Andy, which is occurring to me is that I think if you actually work on these issues, you become aware that one of the big things is the idea of the window of opportunity. So it might be the case that you know a certain group of Al-Qaeda operatives are in the United States, and you come across them. They're not about to hijack the plane at that point. They're not about to crash it into a building. But you can't be confident, right, that you will be able to come across them again when their attack is imminent. And so is Senator Paul's rule that all those points, possible points in time when you may come across the Al-Qaeda group, say Al-Qaeda cell, call it, the only time that you can attack them is right before they get on the airliner?
So, I mean, this is Steve. I think the short answer to that is, you know, it's important to keep in mind that as the white paper suggests, we have to understand imminence as being part and parcel with the feasibility of capture. And I guess the question is, can we really imagine a scenario where someone who is found in the United States, you know, can't be captured but can be targeted with a drone? That is to say, where we're not in a position to use ordinary law enforcement methods to arrest them. I think that's why all of the drone strikes that have been reported to date have been in parts of the world where there's no functioning civil authority. And so, you know, I don't think we can understand the imminence question without some relationship to whether there are other means of incapacitating these same individuals. You know, as for how you actually measure imminence, I mean, there's a fairly substantial body of case law under the Supreme Court's 1985 decision in Tennessee versus Garner that, you know, develops the question of when law enforcement officers, for example, you know, are in a position where they have no option other than to use lethal force. Not all of this case law is stuff we probably agree with, but it's out there. And so I'm not sure that this is as, you know, meaningless and unmanageable a set of questions as we think. I think for folks who are in the U.S., 99.9% of the time, the answer is going to be that they can be arrested. And in the 0.1 or 0.001% of the time when, you know, a suicide bomber is driving toward a mall or a building that, you know, to which they pose an immediate threat, I don't think anyone would doubt that the government could use lethal force, whether it's the military, the police, or anybody else. Okay. So, I don't know. I mean, it just seems to me that this is not as hard a question.
Let me ask you a question. Did you think that Anwar al-Awlaki was engaged? I mean, let's apply the standards you were defending. I know I'm deviating a little bit from the question here, but let's apply the standards you're advocating to Anwar al-Awlaki. Was really capture not possible? Was he really imminently threatening the United States at the time that the missile killed him?
Well,
it
so, John,
because it seems to me that, you know, the reason why people are so worried about this is that, you know, the administration on the one hand is saying, well, we did apply due process to Anwar al-Awlaki. It's quite clear that he wasn't an imminent threat. You know, it's not a problem if you don't think he has due process rights, right? I mean, he's a member of the enemy and he's a citizen, and unfortunately, you can attack any member of the enemy. But if he did get due process rights, then how was he, you know, imminently going to attack the United States? So instead, the administration, this white paper, had to, and this is, I think this is quite a legitimate concern, right, change the definition of imminence. So it's not like the standard that's used by law enforcement in the United States, right? They said he could be continually planning attacks, right? But if you apply that in a domestic context, you can't use force against someone who's continually planning crimes, right? That's called the crime of conspiracy, in fact, but you can't use force against that person. And so that's, I think that's why it shows that if you really do want to apply this due process test, you have to really change the meaning of due process to fit it, I think, and shoehorn it into military circumstances. And that's why I think people are legitimately concerned about how, you know, given the way they did the Anwar Lockwood case, as far as we know, and from public information, if that's the way they're going to analyze what due process is domestically, that suggests that you would actually use force in more circumstances and still think you're consistent with due process, which means I think the fear is that then you might be, that's going to seep into criminal law enforcement too.
So this is Steve. I mean, I think part of the problem is that we don't actually know how the government analyzed due process in the Alaki case. The white paper is actually rather quiet on the question of just what procedural safeguards the government implemented to make sure they had the right person. But I have to say, I mean, I'm not particularly bothered by the notion that, you know, if the government has the volume of intelligence information it appears to have had in Alaki's case, and if it has the, you know, intelligence information suggesting that Alaki is involved in planning ongoing and future attacks against the United States, and critically, if Alaki is in a part of the world where his capture is infeasible. And I think that's the critical piece here that we often leave out of this conversation. And, you know, that's where I think having the OLC memo would actually be rather helpful to see if they actually analyzed that point and explained why Alaki's capture would have been infeasible. You know, I think
Steve, do you have to do that with respect to the seven people who were standing around him too?
No, because, I mean, it's a military attack, and, you know, there are rules governing permissible collateral damage, right?
So the one guy we know is the enemy is the one who gets the due process, and the seven guys standing around
him. I mean,
Andy, that's how
laws of war have worked for, you know, centuries.
Okay.
I just wanted to make sure I had my brain
around the logic of all this.
Listen, I mean, Andy, you know this as a prosecutor. It's the same with surveillance, right? If the government targets someone for surveillance, the target's going to have more protections, for example, under FISA, than individuals whose information is incidentally or accidentally picked up as part of that surveillance. I mean, that's just the way the world works, right? That when the government is choosing to focus its energies at a particular person, that's when it has to meet a certain threshold. And I think
I thought the underlying assumption of this was that a higher standard was required because this is lethal force.
Well, Andy, I think a higher standard is required, and also, I mean, I think the government always has to meet some threshold when it uses any force against its citizens. All I'm trying to suggest is that, you know, I don't know that it's that foreign to believe that when the government has an individual target, that it has to have more information against that target, and that permissible, acceptable collateral damage doesn't have to be specifically targeted as such.
Right, but what doesn't make sense to me is we're going to go through this painstaking analysis with respect to Alaki, who's in Yemen, because he happens to be an American citizen. And we go through the analysis and we decide, yes, he's somebody who we can legitimately target. And then the point in time comes to do the deed. And then you find that he's, you know, with three other people who may or may not be American citizens. And we haven't gone through any analysis with respect to those people. But we know that they're identifiable. We can take pictures of them. We can figure out who they are. Do we have to not do the operation then because we haven't given them the due process they're entitled to?
No, Andy, I mean, that's true in law enforcement. If a law enforcement officer is
so even with lethal force doesn't change the analysis then?
No, I mean, Andy, with the law enforcement officer, right, if a law enforcement officer is responding to a violent felon with force, with a permissible use of lethal force, and he accidentally shoots an innocent bystander, you know, there's no jurisdiction in the country that's going to hold him liable. On the theory that, you know, as long as the use of force was permissible, you know, understandable non-negligent accidents or collateral damage, acceptable collateral damage, unpleasant though it may be morally, is within the scope of the law. So I think we have to keep our eyes on the prize here. And that question is, when the government is specifically targeting U.S. citizens, is it really that preposterous to demand that they actually justify the ground on which they are specifically targeting a U.S. citizen, at least after the fact, to a neutral decision maker? And, you know, I may just be alone on this one.
I think Andy has a good point. I mean, I think the fundamental point here is that there is and has been a difference between law enforcement and military operations. And what I see the Obama administration doing, I think you're defending them on this point, is taking very clear standards that we've used in law enforcement and applying them to war. what you say may sound reasonable for law enforcement. We've never required those standards for military operations in any past war, where officials of the government can be called into account to in court to explain their targeting decisions. Now, that may make a lot of sense in the criminal law enforcement period. And you could say, well, maybe this is a good idea in the military perspective. I think one thing that might separate us is that we think there's lots of unforeseen consequences to that will occur in lots of other areas of war fighting that we can't even predict, and that war fighting system has served the country pretty well for 200-some years, and it might be a mistake, a very big mistake, to go down that step without really thinking about it. And so, again, that's why I keep thinking of this, like, yeah, you're analyzing the Anwar al-Awlaki case in this way, but suppose you took the exact same way of thinking and applied it to a criminal. I think it shows that you've had to also change. So that's what concerns me, not just the military effect on the military, but the effect it'll have on domestic law enforcement operations. Because I can't think that an American citizen at home who's just a criminal, we're not at war with the guy, he can't be captured. Say we can't capture him, but he's planning crimes that might be very harmful against the United States. I still don't think that we would think due process would allow us to shoot him, unless he is imminently about to actually harm someone. That's the real law enforcement standard. And I think the white paper, as it describes due process, is not the standard that we actually use at home. So I think there's two concerns. I think you could be seriously degrading the military's ability to do its job, but you're also in creating this kind of hybrid one-size-fits-all system. You're also going to undermine liberties in the criminal justice. I'm afraid, I'm not a huge libertarian, but I'd be the first to admit, I think things like this happened with the war on drugs. I think we made a lot of compromises in fighting the war on drugs and changing, I think, individual liberties in order to fight that war. But I think that's another example where these kinds of things can happen.
Well, we've got more questions, I'm afraid, than we have time left. I'm going to ask our callers to be very brief and succinct, if they could, with their questions. Let's go to the next caller.
Yes, this is Jim Haynes. I'm a member of the Federal Society, and I really appreciate this call, and I want to compliment you all. I'm going to try to speak up, if I can, on behalf of all of the teenagers who read Atlas Shrugged.
I'm sorry. I was just making a rhetorical joke. I liked the book too when I was a teenager.
But all the teenagers I know are on their electronic games, so it falls some of us who are a little older. But I wanted to make one point that I think I didn't hear made, and I thought was really important about the Paul filibuster, and that was that I think Rand Paul is to be complimented for not going out and filing a lawsuit. I think that the consensus of you gentlemen was that this is in large part a political question, and that it's very, very hard for courts to say or do anything that is going to be meaningful in the real world about this. And so I would say that a Senate filibuster, which plays to the issue before the public eye and the public mind in a democratically elected body, a political branch, is probably a good thing. And I compliment him for not just rushing down to the U.S. District Court. Secondly, I read some history, and so I would just offer, without necessarily very much more comment, do you think that this administration would have authorized drone strikes on Ezra Pound or P.G. Wodehouse, both of whom?
Is it just because death to bad poets?
as you may recall, Pound made some broadcasts for Mussolini and was captured by American forces during World War II, and P.G. Wodehouse was captured by the Germans and made some broadcasts from German studios, and both of those were pretty controversial in their time. Have we gotten so casual about this that being a bad poet, perhaps, would be enough to put you on the list? You talked about Nazi saboteurs and due process or not due process. I'm troubled because our same government during World War II locked up over 100,000 Japanese civilians and never has precisely said that they had due process rights that were violated. I'm concerned with the lessons of history and with the fallibility of politicians. I'm concerned with John and Robert Kennedy conspiring to kill Castro or to kill President Jim. And, you know, what that says about ultimately in the pressure of the real world when powerful people want to reach quick solutions, how they are inclined to cut corners. Now, drone strikes are particularly easy, particularly secret, and particularly effective. What distinguishes them from snipers is that it is even harder for anybody else to get in there and figure out what really happened. No media, no observers, no disclosure. My concern is really that as these things become normed into society and we define whatever this is that we're doing, sort of keep defining it down, that you're going to find drone strikes against organized drug cartels in parts of South America where our government decides there's no effective civil authority. And you're going to find drone strikes in situations analogous to Ruby Ridge or Waco or the occasionally talked about, quote, domestic terrorists, close quote. And as long as this business is cloaked as national security and war powers, it becomes very difficult for anybody in the Senate or anybody in the House or anybody else to know very much about what is being done by our government in our names. So I suppose that's what the teenagers would be saying. But
who wants to react to that?
Please go ahead.
Any of our experts want to react?
I mean, I guess all I'll just say is, I mean, I actually, this is Steve, I actually share Jim's concern about the potential proliferation of the use of drone strikes. I think that's part of why, even for those of us, and I think that probably includes all three of the of us on the panel, who are generally supportive of the current administration's use of drone strikes. I think there are reasons to want greater, you know, greater transparency and greater limits. Or at least greater understanding of what the limits are on when the government can use lethal force. So even if one's inclined toward John and Andy's view that, you know, in war the gloves are off, that you know, anyone, citizen or non, can be the subject of military force, it still begs the question of whether, in fact, these individuals are valid targets. You know, Jim brought up the example of internment camps during World War II. Let's not forget, we didn't just intern Japanese Americans during World War II. We interned, you know, thousands of Japanese, German, and Italian nationals under the terms of the Alien Enemy Act of 1798, and gave most of them judicial hearings where they got to say, hey, I'm not actually a national of a country with whom we're at war. Most of them lost, but they got their day in court. And so, you know, I think to my mind, the question is, how do we make sure going forward this authority doesn't proliferate past the point of where we're all comfortable with it? And I don't think just taking the administration's word for it is going to be the way to do that.
Go ahead, Andy.
I was just going to say, I think that this may be slightly off the point, but there's a lot of good reasons 12 years down the road that we ought to be revisiting the AUMF and fine-tuning it for the current reality of the war. I think a lot of that has to do with a better definition of who the enemy is, but I also think that they could visit at this point, with, you know, 12 years experience in how Al-Qaeda operates, what kind of uses of force would be appropriate in the United States. I'm not at all offended by the thought that we could do that. My only point is that I think that once Congress has authorized whatever it authorizes, that it has to be the Commander-in-Chief's determination in the first instance to deal with the enemy.
I guess to me, I think one of the things about your question, I think I've been trying to press home, is that the that one always has to be worried about how this might change the rest of the law enforcement system, which is what, you know, all the citizens of this country live under. And so when you raise things like Ruby Ridge or maybe Waco, things like that, where the United States used some very heavily armed law enforcement and I think in some cases called in military assistance, I think in Waco maybe, but I don't remember the facts that clearly anymore, that you worry about the changes in domestic law that are going to be driven by changes in military technology. Now, part of that is there was this desire, I think, that was mistaken to too strictly keep those worlds apart. When you look at the pre-9/11 world, one of the major ways that the government and the courts tried to enforce that separation was by preventing the intelligence agencies from really having very much contact with the domestic law enforcement agencies, and that's really the source of this wall, which prevented the CIA and the FBI from easily sharing information about al-Qaeda terrorists moving in and out of the country. So we don't want to, I think, have a total wall of separation between the two. On the other hand, I think that if we shouldn't unnecessarily dilute domestic constitutional standards and domestic legal standards in order to satisfy concerns about how we conduct the drone strikes or any other kind of armed attacks abroad. I think Mr. Haynes's question would be satisfied not necessarily through constitutional standards, but if we have more confidence in the way the administration articulates its policies and carries it out. And I think the best way for that to happen is not through court action, not through demanding people get warrants or pre-clearance from courts, but I think it would be best carried out the way we carry out covert action generally and military action generally, which is that the Congress performs its oversight function, and sometimes they have to do it in secret when it's to the country's advantage, and that we should ask our members in Congress to make sure that they fully understand what the executive branch is doing. And if they don't like what they're doing, then they can hold them to account in a large variety of ways, including what we're seeing right now, which is by holding up nominations, cutting off funding, and all sorts of things. That's how we conduct covert action. That's how we really generally conduct the operations of the military. I don't think that it's a good idea to upset that system. I think it has served the country fairly well over the last two centuries.
Well, we are technically out of time, but let me see if we can take one final question. We've got more questions pending. We might have to reconvene this call at a later date, but let's take one final question, and if everybody could be as brief as possible in framing the question and answering.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Actually, my question is not really a question. It's more of a clarification for Professor Vladek. I wanted to know, what were the Supreme Court cases that you were citing? I know you mentioned the Hamdi case. What were the other cases you were mentioning?
Sure, I'm sorry. So the Hamdi case in 2004, the Hamdan case in 2006, in which the Supreme Court held both that Common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention applies to the non-international armed conflict with al-Qaeda, and that the military commissions established by President Bush were unlawful. And then the Boumediene versus Bush decision in 2008, where the court said that the non-citizens held as enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay were entitled to pursue habeas relief under the suspension clause of the Constitution. I think all three of those cases stand for a proposition that perhaps John and Andy disagree with, and that's their right, which is that courts not just are able to, but in some cases are required to, provide a forum for certain individuals to challenge their detention, to challenge their amenability to the use of military force during wartime. And I think, as long as those cases are on the books, it's pretty hard to argue against some similar, modicum of process for U.S. citizens who are targeted in drone strikes.
All right. Thank you.
And Andy McCarthy or John Yu, anything on that point or final thought before we adjourn?
No, for once I agree with his answer, which is those are the cases he cited.
Yeah, that's obviously true. I guess, Eisentrager was a bright line at one time too, but that was a better time.
All right. Well, we are out of time, and let me thank our experts today for what I think is a fascinating call. And I'm sorry to those members of the audience who remain on the line who still have questions pending. As I suggested, maybe we'll reconvene this call at some point in the near future. My thanks to Professors John Yu and Stephen Vladek and Mr. Andy McCarthy for joining us today. To our audience, again, I invite you to join us for our Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 1 p.m. with Yale Law School Professor John Macy as we talk about his new book, The Death of Corporate Reputation. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org /multimedia.